Thinking Aloud from the University of Warwick.
Hello, welcome to Thinking Aloud. I'm Jenny Bond, an MA History student at the University of Warwick. Joining me today is Professor Stephen Pinkus, Professor of History at Yale University. Professor Pinkus's recent book, 1688, The First Modern Revolution, re-examines traditional interpretations of England's glorious revolution, arguing persuasively that it was not a bloodless, consensual and aristocratic affair, but a truly revolutionary one with widespread ramifications for Britain's economic and foreign policy. Professor Pinkus's research also includes Britain's political and economic interests in the 17th and 18th century, the origins of British Empire and early Atlantic history. His work crosses many disciplinary boundaries. Professor Pinkus, thank you for joining us today. May I start by asking you to talk about your favourite primary source?
Sure. Well, I'm quite interested in the Harley papers, the Harley manuscripts, which are mostly at the British Library. And the reason why I'm keen to look at them is because of the range of interests which are represented in the collection. So the collection has mostly been used by political historians. That is to say, it includes Sir Robert Harley's, Robert Harley and then future Prime Minister of the Earl of Oxford, his political correspondence. But there's so much else in the archive, including his notes on a variety of religious issues, for my purposes, what I was extremely excited to see is a variety of projects for imperial endeavors, including a plan to conquer South America, notes on finance, on the debt, huge numbers of calculations, and indeed a whole bunch, a range of antiquarian interests. It includes notes on various travels that he takes throughout England and notes how things change. So part of what I find really rich about this is that it pushes scholars not to think in sort of traditional subcategories of history, that is to say social and economic history, cultural history, intellectual history, political history, economic history, but in fact encourages one to think of history as a totality, the way that people experience the past, not in subcategories of history. And it strikes me that one of the real dangers that the historical profession has suffered from in the past half century has been the vociferousness of the historical profession, dividing various aspects of human experience from one another, which had the advantage, of course, of focusing study, but it had the disadvantage of not seeing how one lives lives whole. I mean, it would be unthinkable today to imagine that that, you know, one person only focused on one's bank account and not on possibly watching television, going to the theater, reading the newspaper, bringing up one's children, and yet historians insist on studying these things separately, and it strikes me that the Harley collection encourages us not to think that way.
Thank you, that's very interesting. And have you tried to use this sort of rich interdisciplinary source in a new way? Are you the first person to sort of point out this is such a rich source, or have lots of other historians used these
sources before? Lots and lots of other historians have used the Harley papers. I think Professor Knights has used them extensively. What I think I'm the first person to do is to recover the imperial projects, which were central to what Harley was doing. So nobody else has looked at the South Sea Company, the attempts to create an empire in South America, or I think paid as much attention to his political economic calculations, which are themselves extremely interesting. So, you know, I went through fairly carefully the political correspondence, although I think there are some others who have gone through it more carefully than I have done. But what I think I'm the first to do is to try to put these things together. And I did spend a lot of time going through the cultural, a lot of the sort of cultural effusions in the papers. I mean, there are, in Harley's papers, there are, I think, something like 56 unlabeled or scarcely labeled volumes. And those people haven't used as much as the correspondence. And that's where I found the sort of richness of his own historical experience, his own interests in history, but also his interests in a variety of contemporary endeavor.
Thank you, that sounds really fascinating to read. Could you just talk to us really briefly as well about your favourite secondary source?
Okay. Well, I mean, there are two books that I want to draw one's attention to, because both are great books in a lot of ways. With and many scholars have focused on perhaps the shortcomings of the books, but it strikes me that I want to emphasize how great they are. And the two are Robert Brunner's Merchants and Revolution, which is an account, well, in a sense, it's an account of the causes and consequences of the English Revolution told from the perspective of merchants and empire. Sir Christopher Bailey's Imperial Meridian. Now, what strikes me is great about these books is their ambition. Nobody can take up either of these books and say, I don't see why this is important. One of them attempts to explain why there was an English Revolution in the middle of the 17th century and offers broader thinking about why revolutions happen more generally. So even if one isn't interested in 17th century England, even if one isn't interested in England, there's good reason for one to read that book. And similarly, Sir Christopher Bailey's Imperial Meridian offers an account of why the British Empire became authoritarian in the late 18th, early 19th century. And he does this by placing Britain's empire in dialogue with things that are happening in Asia, in the Middle East, but tries again to sort of map politics, social and economic change, cultural change into an entire story. And it's the ambition of these books that I think is truly remarkable. Now, each of these books, you know, I'll be the first one to say I don't agree with everything in them. But that's not the point. The point is the ambition that's making one think broadly. And I think we as historians have settled in the past two or three decades into doing the sort of cautious, safe, and empirically true kind of history. And that strikes me as not terribly interesting. People in other disciplines don't want to read that, and it's very difficult to convince the larger world that that's important. That's why I think one really needs to encourage these big, ambitious books. The important thing is asking big, ambitious questions. That's much more important, it seems to me, than getting the right answer. And I think historians of the past two or three decades have been too focused on getting the right answer or something which they think they can defend as right, and not interested in asking the good questions. So a great historian, to my mind, is not somebody who gets the answer right, but who asks the right question, and that future generations of historians struggle to answer his or her question, not decide that their answer is right and all run from there. And it strikes me that that's what those two books have achieved.
That sounds fascinating. And these kind of wide, global, interdisciplinary causes and effects that you're looking at, that's something you're trying to also achieve in your own
work. Right, well, yes, I mean, I can't say that I achieved it. I mean, these two people, I mean, have achieved it and have, achieved real breadth and really challenges everyone who reads these books to think more broadly, and that's what it strikes me we should all be aspiring to, and I think for that reason they're both wonderful models. And as I said, the issue isn't whether they've got it right or wrong. The issue is that they've asked these big questions and come up with big answers that we all will have to struggle with. And it strikes me that both of these books are ones where one could, go up to any sort of educated or semi-educated person on the street and say, this is what this book is about. Does this seem interesting to you? And they'll inevitably say yes. Whereas I think sort of narrower studies, which are more cautious, more right, it's very difficult to convince the non-specialist that this is important.
Certainly very interesting, especially today when we're looking at wider global themes and issues. Yes, excellent. Well, thank you very, very much for talking to us and taking time today. And thank you very much for listening to this new series of Thinking Aloud.